Australia's set to launch a $2 billion fund for small countries in the Pacific to counter China's rising influence in the region. The fund was launched by Prime Minister Scott Morrison on Thursday. It's set to be a combination of grants and low-interest loans to build infrastructure.
Burberry says its new designer is delivering the buzz it needs for a turnaround. These among the first works for the company by Riccardo Tisci. His debut collection for the British brand well received by fashion bloggers. Now it might please the firm's accountants too. First half earnings down a little to $1.6 billion, but still beating forecasts.
With only one out of 100 qualified pilots being women in China, the country has one of the world's lowest rates of female pilots. But there's a boom in China's middle class, and with it, a growing appetite for travel. Chinese airlines are struggling with a pilot shortage, and according to forecasts by plane maker Boeing, Chinese carriers will need more than 100,000 new pilots over the next two decades.
Now, WGN Radio's daily conversation about the life of business and the business of life. This is The Opening Bell with Steve Grzanich on 720 WGN.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the program. It is Friday, and it's November the 9th, 5:11 in the morning. Thank you for tuning in this morning to another edition of The Opening Bell. It's another business day also getting underway. But hey, we made it to Friday. Thank you again for listening in this morning. We'll get to all of the market news coming up. Paul Nolte is here today from Kingsview Asset Management in Chicago, a regular Friday conversation with Paul. We'll talk about the economy, the markets, the Fed. A little bit later in the program, Brian Summers will be here from Skift.com for our regular Friday chat. We've got an update on the Boeing 737 MAX investigation from Indonesia and how it is impacting the United States. Brian will be on at about 5:40 this morning. So a pretty good show for you on this Friday. Let's get underway with the WGN Associated Bank Market Desk. Futures are pointing toward losses on Wall Street later this morning, with the S&P down more than 0.5%. S&P futures down more than 0.5%. Same story on the NASDAQ, almost 0.75% there. Dow futures down 127 points. That's almost 0.5% as well. As we look around the world, markets are in the red in Europe. The FTSE, the DAX, the CAC, all lower by more than 0.5%. And in Asia, markets also lower in Japan by more than 1%. China the rest of Asia, too, more than 1.5%. The Hang Seng down 2.33% as markets around the world and in the United States all in the red this morning. Oil is trading at $59.70 a barrel, which is down about 97 cents. Couple of stories before we begin this morning. Mickey Mouse celebrating a very good quarter after his 90th birthday in May. Disney beat Wall Street projections in earnings and revenue on the strength of its studio quarterly revenue that grew 50% year over year. The company reported revenue of more than $14 billion and is paying earnings of $1.48 a share. Disney shares were 2%, up 2% in after-hours trading. Its movie studio division had a strong performance with the release of hits like Black Panther, Star Wars, The Last Jedi, Avengers, Infinity War, and Incredibles 2. The scooter company Bird is fighting back against one of the most common complaints it hears. It's urging people to report any badly parked or damaged scooters. The scooters are available in more than 100 cities across the country. Let anyone ride them and park them wherever they want. Many have complained of parking in the middle of sidewalks that's created hazards for pedestrians. Bird's CEO says that they can work with communities to make streets safer and people-friendly, but they need to work with their customers to try to get these scooters out of people's hands. October producer prices lead off today's report, analyst forecasting a gain of about 0.2%. Paul Nolte is here this morning for our regular Friday conversation. Paul, good morning. Happy Friday.
Good morning. Happy snowy Friday.
Yeah, exactly. I don't know if you've been to a community yet that has these scooters that I was talking about.
Charlotte, I think, does. And I was down there just briefly. But, yeah, we were driving around, and you'd see them laying all over the place. It was really kind of odd.
Yeah, I was watching one of the cable news networks last weekend, and they were on location in Atlanta. And in back of them, you could see, because they were on a streetscape, just the scooters going back and forth and back. I mean, just dozens of people on scooters.
No, it's a very different, it's an interesting and very convenient mode of transportation if you don't have to go too terribly far.
Right.
But, yeah, as far as where do you dock them, it just drop them wherever.
And do they have snow tires on them? The other thing. So, Paul, what is the big news this morning? What from this past week is the highlight in your world this morning?
Well, really, surprisingly enough, one of the highlights was the election. I mean, we kind of expected the election to go as it did, and we didn't expect the markets to react too terribly much to it. But once the election was done, we saw the markets rise by 2%. And that was kind of a surprise. And there were certainly winners and losers within the market based upon what many guess would be new legislation or new constraints, if you will, on business. So you had healthcare stocks do very well. As we've talked, marijuana stocks did very well, especially after Jeff Sessions resigned. And thinking there's a way forward then for legalized marijuana in the U.S. Banking stocks struggled because they saw additional constraints from Dodd-Frank. So it was kind of a mixed bag from that perspective, but the fact that the market was up 2% was really kind of a surprise. And then certainly the Fed meeting yesterday leaving things unchanged. Those were the two big highlights for the week.
And to tear this apart a little bit further, the healthcare stocks up because of some optimism that there might be some bipartisan way to fix healthcare, or is that being optimistic?
The word bipartisan is something I think that has disappeared from the lexicon in Washington. But yes, that is the hope that, and certainly Trump alluded to it in his conversation, press conference afterwards, after the election results, that there could be some way forward to fix health care and make it better for Americans that are on that plan or looking to get onto that plan. Whether that's the case or not, again, going through legislation is going to be a tough process. But you know, there's certainly some optimism that that's going to happen.
Yeah, the Democrats, too, talking about perhaps reaching across the aisle for an infrastructure plan. That's something that we haven't really seen much of lately, so that would be a positive thing.
Yeah, and we saw it in a lot of the concrete stocks, the construction firms, the engineering firms. They all did well. They were up 3, 4, 5% right after the election on that expectation. But we've heard this before as far as an infrastructure bill. That was certainly one of the things that the Republicans ran on 2 years ago, and yeah, Not much happened. So yeah,
when they controlled both houses of Congress.
When they had control, nothing really happened there. So, there's a lot of hope and optimism with this election that things are going to happen and get done. Mm-hmm. And we'll see what happens come January.
Right. And so let me play the pessimist here, because if you have a split Congress to both houses are different, you know, there's a good chance nothing gets done over the next 2 years.
Right. And I think, you know, it depends upon whether they can put the partisanship to the side and actually agree on something. And unfortunately, the way we've watched voting develop over the last 20 years or so, it has gotten further and further apart as opposed to closer and closer together, where there actually is some reaching across the aisle and some compromises being made.
Paul, you mentioned the Fed earlier. Their two-day meeting ended with no rate change, but they signaled, as you mentioned, that they're moving forward with another increase in December.
Yeah, and you know, really, when you look at the statement, you know, there's a lot of people that look at the August statement, the September statement, and they put them down side by side, and then they highlight the changes. And the changes were still for growth. They really didn't change too much of the wording in their statement, but still highlighted that the economy is still growing strongly. But they did see some moderation in some of the some parts of the economy and some of the manufacturing sectors. But when you look at what the expectations are through the Fed funds rate, December is a given, a 90% chance or higher. It looks right now at least two more rate hikes in March and June, and actually a rate cut in 2020. So if you have to peg and say, you know, here's where the economy falls apart, the Fed at least may signal that 2020 might be that period of time.
Interesting. Mid-2020, late 2020?
That part is, you know, from this distance, anytime in 2020.
Yeah, right. We have
trouble forecasting much beyond 6 weeks. So to go out to 2020 is a little bit of a stretch.
And so what does that do? I mean, if you're an investor looking at this, that's a long time to prepare, right?
It is. You know, when you do take a look at it, you know, with the yield curve started to flatten out again, which means that the two-year yield, the difference between the two-year and the 10-year yield has gotten narrower. The 2-year yield has picked up a little bit. 10-year's kind of flattened out. So the difference between the two is about 0.25%. So if the Fed were actually to go through with their rate hikes sometime early next year, that curve would invert, meaning the 2-year yields are actually higher than the 10-year yields. And historically, that has signaled a recession a year to 18 months out, which again puts it into 2020. Whether that happens or not, again, we'll have to wait and see. But that's one of the concerns that many investors are seeing right now. The dollar has picked up strength because with stronger interest rates here, or higher interest rates, that actually supports the dollar. So the combination of higher interest rates and a stronger dollar actually creates a tightening of financial conditions in the United States. And we haven't even talked yet about the Fed reducing their balance sheet, which is also tightening monetary policy in other ways. So we're getting into a very tight monetary policy environment that historically doesn't do well for stocks over the long run. In the short run, the stock market can continue to do well. The economy's doing fine. Earnings are doing fine. But we're on our last go-round, if you will. And we can see the markets struggling, if not first quarter, maybe certainly second quarter next year, as they anticipate a more slowing in the economic activity.
And so then what would we do with our portfolios in that case? Are there still buying opportunities, or is it time to start putting away some nuts?
Oh, they're absolutely starting to, take some money off the table. We've done that. We've sitting on a little bit more cash. We've adjusted the portfolios a little bit more toward value. So growth, which has done so well over the last 8 years, has started to struggle a little bit relative to the markets. Facebook, Amazon, you know, those are the FANG stocks, certainly have struggled a little bit. The consumer staples, healthcare, those are typically the more defensive parts of the market. Those have started to do well and have been doing well since June. So we're seeing that shift in the market as investors have already started to begin preparing for maybe a slowdown in the economy and looking at those parts of the market. And I think that makes some sense here. So it is we could see a market up another 5, maybe even as much as 10%. But I don't think the risks, I think, are starting to get, they're starting to build at least for a little bit more downside than upside over the next 12 to 18 months.
What do you like these days?
We do like the defensive parts of the market. You know, they are cheap. Certainly those that are paying dividends are good. We've seen it actually in some of the old tech sector, the Intel's, Cisco's, maybe not so much Microsoft, but they're paying 2 to 3% in the way of dividends, and they've got good earnings. We still like international, but international is all over the place. You know, it did extremely well coming off the election. It was up 3, 4%. Yesterday down another 1 to 2%. So it's a very volatile part of the market, but we think international could do well. The dollar is strong. That hurts international for us sending money overseas, but we don't think the dollar strength is going to last too terribly long if we do wind up going into a recession at some point, or certainly an economic slowdown. The dollar will come down a little bit, and that'll help our international investments over the next 1 to 3 years or so. And if you're investing in bonds, you want to keep your maturities fairly short. You'd like to be able to turn those over and buy those higher yields as the yields pick up over the next 6 months to a year.
Always good information, Paul. We appreciate it. How can people have this conversation with you one-on-one if they want?
If they want to drop me a note, email is best. That's pnolte@kingsviewam.com.
And also get subscribed to Nolte's Notes,
yes,
which come out every week. Those
every week or so.
Yeah, right to your inbox.
A little bit tongue-in-cheek, but one page, and get a short look at the markets.
It's always good information. Paul, thank you. Have a great weekend.
Thank you. Talk to you soon.
Paul Nolte from Kingsview Asset Management in Chicago.
Now, WGN Radio's Daily Conversation about the life of business and the business of life. This is The Opening Bell with Steve Grzanich on 720 WGN.
Good morning again, everyone. Welcome back to the program. Thanks for being here with us on our Friday edition of The Opening Bell. Lots going on in the world of aviation business this week, including news on the 737 investigation from Indonesia and how it's impacting the United States. And food on airlines. Let's bring in Brian Summers this morning. He's the aviation business editor for Skift.com. Brian is with us via Skype from Los Angeles. Brian, let's begin with the 737 investigation in Indonesia, the Lion Air crash. Boeing and the FAA now have issued bulletins about this here in the United States.
Sure. As people probably remember, on October 29th, Lion Air, an Indonesian low-cost airline, had a crash on a 737 MAX. It killed 189 people. And we've learned a little bit more about what happened. Investigators in Indonesia have said the plane's computers may have commanded a steep dive of the airplane, so the computers may have essentially forced this crash. And from what they're saying, it sounds like the airplane may have thought it was in a stall. Of course, that was incorrect. And then an automated system, which didn't want it to be in the stall, would have commanded it to dive to regain speed. According to Bloomberg and some other outlets, there may have been a problem with something called the angle of attack sensor on the aircraft. And I guess this had been replaced the day before. So as you mentioned, Boeing has issued an alert to its customers. And those customers in the United States for the 737 MAX include American, United, and Southwest. And Boeing said, basically, you know, we know that this could happen. Pilots are trained. Sometimes the airplane wants to do certain things in autopilot mode. Pilots can overrule that. Apparently, it's not that difficult, but they have to know what they're doing. The FAA also was set to issue an airworthiness directive. So all that really does is say, you know, Boeing had this idea, airlines were probably going to follow it anyways, but now they have to follow it. And just a reminder to people, this is a brand new airplane, essentially. The first one came out in 2017. It is still a 737, but it is a very updated version with lots of new technology. And so it'll be interesting to see what happens here, if maybe the technology failed or something happened. We just don't know at this point. But it is interesting to see this airworthiness directive.
Yeah, and so in layman's terms, really, I think just to summarize that basically pilots can get familiar again with this system and this particular device so that they know what to do in case this happens.
Exactly.
Yeah. Brian, let's talk about another story that I find just absolutely interesting. How airlines know how much food they're going to need for each flight. This is a cool story that you wrote about just how sort of, you know, prepared the airlines are, but not so much in a way.
Well, that's true. I find food to be a very interesting subject. I think a lot of people have been on an airplane and perhaps you're sitting in the third to the last row and you want a certain sandwich or salad and the airline is out of it and you get very upset. I hate to say it, but often that's by design. One of the reasons is it's very hard to keep food fresh on an airplane. And so at the end of every flight, mostly the U.S. carriers are throwing out everything that had been cold. So your salads, your sandwiches, your things like that. They really don't want to throw out that food, right? Because that's cost going into the garbage. And so they're doing their absolute best to sell everything. Of course, they fail at that a lot, but at least they're trying. So that's why airlines run out. You know, it's 2018, and I've been talking to a lot of airlines about this, and a few of them have data scientists, and data scientists are hired to fix problems like this. So I was dealing with a UK airline, a European airline called EasyJet. They put their data science team on this, and they found that on an average flight, they were throwing out three pieces of fresh food at the end of every flight. And over the course of a year, you know, that's a lot of food that they were throwing out. I think they said 800,000 fresh items. So airlines are trying to get much smarter about this. It's a little bit different with drinks, because obviously drinks aren't perishable. You can carry 12 extra Cokes and, you know, you just use them for the next flight. But 12 extra Cokes add up in terms of weight. We know that weight means that airlines have to carry more fuel. Fuel is expensive. And that's the type of thing that adds up across, you know, 6,000 flights a day as well.
Yeah, and for the data people that are trying to get a handle on this, it's not as simple as it sounds because, as you write in your story, you may have somebody who's on a Midwest flight that wants a Coke and a burger and somebody on a Los Angeles flight who wants water and kale salad. So there are the individual tastes of people come into play here too, don't they?
Absolutely. So, you know, as you say, I live in Los Angeles and we have fun with this, but apparently the stereotypes are true, at least according to JetBlue. People on flights to Los Angeles are drinking a lot less Coke and a lot more water. Another thing that every airline tells me, and it's kind of hilarious, is they sell far more alcohol on flights to Las Vegas than anywhere else. And so JetBlue has a pretty standard way of catering their airplanes. They've just decided that efficiency is best, standardization is best, and basically every flight is going to have the same makeup of drinks. They tried doing that with Las Vegas, and after a while they learned, you know what, we can't disappoint these people. We cannot run out of beer every single time. So Las Vegas is an outlier, and it gets different catering than everywhere else.
Brian, there's another story that, you know, we were following here in Chicago this week about GoGo. They reported earnings over the past week and not so good in terms of how they're faring these days.
Yeah, GoGo has had a tough time over the last few years. I think people remember that Chicago-based GoGo was really the first company to put sustainable Wi-Fi on airplanes. American Airlines and Delta had it as recently as about 2008 and 2009. But we're a decade later now, and GoGo has fallen behind a little bit. The technology that they used early on was something called air-to-ground. It wasn't a satellite-based system. People know that it was slow. It wasn't always reliable. And people blame GoGo for this. It probably wasn't entirely GoGo's fault. GoGo could have moved to satellite earlier, but airlines are their customers. And I don't think that in 2012, 2013, 2014, all airlines were convinced that they needed a high-speed internet on their planes. Now, of course, it's 2018. People expect Wi-Fi to be exactly the same on the airplane as it is everywhere else. There's some technological reasons why that's very difficult, but a lot of airlines are moving toward that. And I wrote this week that GoGo had had American, as I mentioned, as a customer for a long time. American is still sort of a customer, but they've moved planes to a GoGo competitor called Viasat. They might be a little bit faster, they might be a little bit more reliable, and that's hurt GoGo financially quite a bit.
So is there a path forward here to profitability? I know that your story says that they have about $1 billion in long-term debt. So what's the path forward?
Well, for me to predict, they've been a public company for about 5 years. They've never had a profitable quarter. You know, every earnings call I listen to, they tell you that they're on the right track. Maybe they are. I don't know. Maybe they'll sell the company at some point. Maybe there will be some consolidation in the in-flight Wi-Fi space. The good thing for GoGo is that customers and airlines want its product. You can imagine there are a lot of companies out there that are struggling, and nobody wants what they're selling. But in this case, we've learned over a long time that people who get on airplanes want to have Wi-Fi. Airlines want to give them Wi-Fi. And so GoGo has a reason for existing. What they haven't been able to do so far is have this reason for existing and make a profit. I'm not sure that there's a lot of hope there, but at least it's a possibility because the core business is something that people want.
All right, Brian, good conversation. We'll see you again next week.
Thank you, Steve.
Brian Summers is aviation business editor for Skift.com. Follow along on at Skift on Twitter and Brian Summers at Brian Summers on Twitter as well.
You're listening to the opening bell on 720 WGN.
On the WGN Associated Bank Market Desk, futures are pointing toward opening losses on Wall Street later this morning. Weakness in the 0.5% range on the Dow and S&P, nearly 1% on the NASDAQ. And let's find out what's happening in the world of agriculture and commodities. Orion Samuelson is with us this morning, and I believe he's in Kansas City. Good morning, Orion.
Well, good morning to you, Steve. Checking in from Kansas City, where we had about an inch or two of snow last night. Stayed on the ground for a while, but as I look out the windows at the hotel here this morning, it looks like we've kind of melted away and we're wet instead of snowy. We're winding up the 75th annual convention of the National Association of Farm Broadcasting, and that will come to an end tomorrow. But it gives us an opportunity to talk to a lot of farm broadcasters across the country And it's interesting the diversity in harvest progress we're seeing, because some areas are finished, combines are parked, other areas still trying to get it done. And in the Dakotas, for example, they'll probably be waiting now for the fields to freeze so they can move the heavy equipment, the combines and the other harvesting equipment, back out onto the fields. But we've had a good 3 days, Max Armstrong and I, working here at this convention. We've heard from quite a few people, including a visit with Bill Northey, who is the Undersecretary for Agriculture, with Secretary Sonny Perdue, who did not make the convention this year. But Bill Northey, the former Secretary of Agriculture for the state of Iowa, now part of USDA, was here, and I asked him about the farm bill, and he said, not done yet, but we're working on it. We hope to have it done by the end of the year. So that's about as optimistic as we can get for the moment on progress on the farm bill.
Orion, being able to talk to farm broadcasters from all over the country, you get probably one of the best report cards possible on how the agriculture community is doing. What are your colleagues telling you from other parts of the country?
Well, if they have a lot of dairy farmers in their farming community that they serve on radio and TV, they're talking about major challenges facing the dairy industry. Hopeful that when the new NAFTA, I haven't gotten around to calling it by its new name yet, but NAFTA, when they get that approved by Congress, which now probably won't happen until after the first of the year, they're concerned that we don't get enough aid for dairy producers, some improvement in the relationship with Canada, but I don't think enough yet to satisfy dairy farmers across the country who are really hurting. And, of course, there's trade talk, and when are we going to get things straightened out with China? So a lot of questions in the air now as we get ready to wrap up 2018.
And then tomorrow on the morning show, more from the Farm Broadcasters Convention, I'm betting.
Yeah, we'll be talking to Bill Northey at length, as a matter of fact, about some of the happenings on the Farm Bill and on the NAFTA agreement, because Congress still has to approve that new agreement with Canada and Mexico. And now we're probably playing with new players on the committee. So a lot of talk about that, and we'll get into that tomorrow on the Saturday morning show.
All right, Orion, thank you very much. Have a good weekend.
You too, Steve.
Orion Samuelson with us again. The morning show tomorrow starting at 5 o'clock right here on 720 WGN. Let's check out the WGN Associated Bank Market Desk outlook for this Friday, November the 9th. Not a lot on the calendar today. We'll get PPI numbers, producer price index, the consumer sentiment numbers out today, report on wholesale trade as well. A couple of Fed speakers out there speaking too today on monetary policy. Just some of the things that could move the markets on this Friday, November the 11th.